Radio Free Press, a podcast from the Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom, campaigning for free, independent and accountable media.
Of the many emerging lessons from the Leveson inquiry, perhaps the most significant for the TUC is that the whole scandal surrounding the unlawful practices of the Murdoch press provides a telling illustration of the corporate abuses which can thrive without the restraining influence of the trade union movement. If the membership of the National Union of Journalists hadn't been banned from Fortress Wapping, then it's very fair to argue that the culture of illegality would almost certainly have been restrained, that at least some of the reporting staff would almost certainly have thought twice before engaging in phone hacking or colluding with the Metropolitan Police in gathering information. Likewise, if union representation had been open to all of News International's employees, then the print workers might well have said no, as they did back in the unionised days of the 1980s, when Murdoch's newspapers like The Sun were trying, and often succeeding, in publishing the kind of inflammatory coverage which flew in the face of the ethical codes of the NUJ and the Press Complaints Commission. Think, too, of the company's financial and administrative staff. If there'd been union representation at Wapping, then perhaps they might have had some serious questions to ask about the tens of thousands of pounds in cash which were being handed over to editorial executives and reporters, and which the police say was being used to pay networks of corrupted public officials. Now, with me to discuss the evidence revealed so far, the challenges and the opportunities which the Leveson inquiry has thrown up for the trade union movement are Michelle Stanistreet, General Secretary of the National Union of Journalists, and Luke Crawley, Assistant General Secretary of BECTU, the Broadcasting and Entertainment Union. First, Michelle Stanistreet, you personally gave evidence to Lord Justice Leveson, and as I watched it online, it seemed to me that the judge and his assessors took on board the NUJ's long-standing case for journalists to have a conscience clause, the right to say no to unethical conduct. Do you think a safeguard like that might have prevented some of the illegality that we've seen unfolding at this Leveson inquiry about what happened at News International?
I think a conscience clause is absolutely vital if journalists are not only to have the confidence to stand up in a newsroom and to say, no, I will not be pressured into behaving unprofessionally or breaking my code of conduct, and they'll have the confidence to know that actually they cannot be sacked in doing so. But it's also about raising the profile of journalistic ethics within the workplace, and it's absolutely the case that journalists at News International haven't had that voice, that independent support within the workplace. For a generation now, the NUJ has been blocked from having any kind of involvement at Wapping, and they haven't had that professional support and voice in the workplace to enable them to stand up and to take any principled view on ethics.
Now, do you think that demand for a conscience clause, which you've put so forcefully and put so forcefully to the Leveson inquiry, do you think that is something that should be at the forefront of the TUC's wider campaign over the trade union response to what's happened and unfolded?
It's absolutely a very important part of it, and it's merely one of the demands that we have placed at the heart of the Leveson inquiry. We've been demanding a conscience clause for many years now, and it's a demand that's had some track within Parliament. A select committee supported this goal, but it's the industry, the PCC and the Society of Editors have resisted this for many years. Now the time has come for their objections to be cast aside and for Leveson to say, actually, this is a very sensible, pragmatic way forward.
Now, Luke Crawley of BECTU, can I turn to you? What for your union is the most important objective that you'd like to see coming out of the Leveson inquiry? Is it, for example, the degree of control which the Murdoch family should continue to have in BSkyB?
I think the big issue, certainly coming out of Leveson, is that it's clear that Murdoch, News International, BSkyB, one man, one person, has been allowed to own too much and have too much power and too much domination of the media. The legislation in this country is framed in such a way that concentration of ownership is looked at, if you like, sector by sector. So in the print, with newspapers and so on, they then try and assess how much the coverage is owned by News International, disregarding entirely B Sky B, 39% owned by News International. And I do think that to make any kind of sense in the future, any kind of media concentration regulation, which there must be some changes to, has to look at the broad picture and has to look at you know, how much is owned across the piece. So that's to say, by whatever means the news is disseminated, whether it's by print, whether it's by television, whether it's by cable, satellite, or online, then there needs to be an assessment by it. And particularly given that, as we've seen with Leveson, there's very, very, very little control about what goes into the press. There is actually a huge amount of control about most of what's broadcast. Broadcasting is subject to quite strict regulation, and that doesn't seem to hamper press freedom. I'm not saying it's a perfect system. It certainly isn't. But it's a system of regulating the press and preventing some of the gross excesses of News International and some of the other papers. It's not just News International papers. The Daily Mail, the Daily Express are also prone to publishing wild, fantastic stories, which I have to say do very little to kind of foster harmony and a great deal to encourage hatred, race hatred and other kinds of antisocial trends.
But should we take it that Bechtu, for example, would support the continued 39% stake which the Murdochs have got in B Sky B, bearing in mind the tremendous investment that there has been in B Sky B, the fact that Sky News, for example, is a widely admired as an alternative news service to the BBC?
The short answer to your first question is no, we don't support Murdoch continuing to own 39%. We do not. Because if they continue to own the newspapers, because remember we're talking about across the piece, then they should not be able to continue to own the 39% and in fact should be forced to divest, sell off their share in it. And I think that would be a wholly reasonable outcome as long as they continue to own the newspapers. The issue about Sky investing in content is an interesting one because Sky does invest in content. But let's be blunt. The news channel is a good thing. Nobody argues against that. But apart from that, the only investing in content they do in any large scale is sport. They buy sport and they rebroadcast it. There should be an obligation on Sky, as there is on other broadcasters in this country, to spend money on original production. And I think there should be an obligation placed upon B Sky B to actually spend a percentage of its turnover on original content made in this country. And I'm talking about as well as the sport and as well as the news.
Michelle Stanistreet, we'll come on to this question of the wider ownership. We'll also come on to the question of the chilling effect, perhaps, that the Leveson inquiry is having on investigative journalism. But first, let's look at the trade union movement. You're in a lead position in this as the Journalists' Union. Do you welcome, are you satisfied with the response that you're getting from the wider trade union movement?
I think it's been an interesting response, and some of the unions have come forward and given evidence, for example, the RMT, about the treatment their union leadership and their union has received in the press in the past. I think the thing that all unions can get behind is how important a role a trade union can play in any workplace in developing a healthy culture. The inquiry, the Leveson inquiry, is looking at the culture, practices and ethics of the press. And the what we've been trying to do very much is to put at the heart of that inquiry the day-to-day experience of journalists when it comes to their work, when it comes to how they're treated by their bosses, unveiling the pretty endemic problem of bullying within the industry, which is a big problem. And we've been trying to outline that very much from the experience of a journalist day-to-day. And I think the rest of the trade union movement and many other workers in other industries have certainly written to us and said it's really important that you're raising those points and raising the issue of the fact that it's not an individual worker who creates a culture in any one workplace. It's actually something that's led from the top, and that's where the responsibility for that workplace, however dysfunctional in the case of News International, the blame lies right at the top of that organisation. And instead what we've seen is a corporate strategic approach to the scandal of phone hacking and all of the other abuses that we've learnt of since. The corporate strategy has been to ring fence and protect those at the top and to blame the journalists much further down the organisational tree.
Now, what you, as the NUJ, have in common with Bechtu, though, is that both unions have been working in an industry where many of the big media groups are, of course, very strongly against it. Do you think that position might change as a result of the Leveson inquiry? I want to ask Luke Crawley about that himself in a moment.
Well, I hope it changes. I'm not saying I'm completely expecting Leveson to turn around and say it's absolutely vital that trade unions have the ability to collectively bargain in our media companies. I'd love it if he did. But I think the message is starting to get through, and I think people are beginning to see the links between you know, where there's a vibrant trade union, and even in many of the workplaces where the NUJ operates, particularly in the national titles, it's a battle. It's a day-to-day battle in the places where we do have recognition many times. But there are so many, as you rightly say, where we have media organisations who are incredibly hostile to the presence of a trade union within their workplaces. So I think there's lots to play for. It's a huge opportunity for us to be making those arguments within the Leveson Inquiry. What finally comes out of it in terms of a recommendation as it applies to trade unions, I think we'll have to see.
Michelle Stanistreet making it clear there that she's not wanting to be too hopeful. What about back to Luke Crawley? Do you have hopes that your industry, broadcasting and entertainment, where you too have faced very anti-union employers, do you think there's any sign of that changing as a result of what's been happening at the Leveson Inquiry?
I think I would say that in our industry, broadcasting and entertainment, the only major employer that's virulently anti-union is Sky. Otherwise, I mean, we have a good relationship, and I think the NUJ also, with ITV, with STV and UTV in Scotland and Northern Ireland, with Channel 4. Channel 5 doesn't employ very many people, and I don't think either of us have a relationship there. But broadly speaking, I think it's a different position. It's not quite as stark as it is in the print. I think the print publishing is very, very much more harsh and anti-union than broadcasting.
And you would say, would you then, that your experience in broadcasting and entertainment demonstrates that it is possible to have a lasting working relationship with the union movement in a way that it's clearly not been possible with many of the national newspaper employers?
I would say absolutely it demonstrates that. To take ITV as an example, we have a long-standing relationship with ITV. It's been through a very difficult period in the last 15 years where all the different franchises were bought up and consolidated into ITV in England and Wales. We managed to build our relationship with them alongside the NUJ in recreating a national agreement. Instead of having to bargain in Leeds, in Manchester, in London and so on, the company did agree that it was a benefit to them as well as us to be able to do that. Now, we've been through difficult times with a huge restructuring, thousands of redundancies, but we're now in a period where the company's posting good results, talking about spending money on programme making, and that's alongside the unions. I don't say that they love us, but they certainly don't hate us, and we have a relationship which works. I think it's an adult, you know, civilised relationship. They can see the benefits to the employer of having a union movement in the workplace, just like we can see the benefit for our members of being able to be recognised and speak on their behalf.
Now, let's look ahead with both of you as to what you would like and what your unions would like to see emerging long term. Now, we know that the government is thinking of a new communications bill, a new communications act. Do you have a blueprint yet at Bechtu as to how you would like to see your industry emerging in the future? Because clearly there's going to be change, and clearly the Leveson Inquiry will have a big input into that.
The Communications Act, whatever it contains, is likely to be only having an impact on our broadcasting members and possibly our film members, but not theatres. And I think in broadcasting there are a number of things which we think are absolutely essential. Perhaps the single most important one is some levelling of the playing field so that all broadcasters are treated the same. By that I mean, I've already touched upon it, B-Sky B needs to be treated in the same way as they would be, for example, if they were in France, or as in fact as Fox News treats the rebroadcasters in the United States, which is to say the public service broadcasters in all the countries of Europe except France, UK and Cyprus, they make the rebroadcaster pay a fee to rebroadcast them. In this country, B-Sky B makes the BBC and ITV and Channel 4 pay a fee to be rebroadcast. And we can see no reason why Sky shouldn't have to pay, as it does in every other territory, to rebroadcast the public service broadcasters. Secondly, I think there's an issue about the obligation to make content, original content in this country. And I can't see any reason why B-Sky B doesn't have that. I well understand how it happened. Margaret Thatcher was quite content to allow the Communications Bill in 1990, or Communications Act in 1990. It's reported, and I don't know if it's true or not, that actually a draft of the bill was sent round to Sky and they asked if they wanted to make any amendments, which of course they did, to be excluded from and made exception to, or whatever practical to be extended. And that means that they spend, as I've said already, very little on original content in this country, apart from sport and news. And I think they need to do more.
Well, a clear plea from Bechtu and hope that there will be increased diversity, that certainly must be your objective, mustn't it, at the NUJ, Michelle Stanistreet, because we've seen, haven't we, in the local and regional newspapers, how it's now consolidated down into just four big groups. We're all, as journalists, very concerned about the future of the national press. Do you see, as we go through the Leveson Inquiry, as the government begins to consult over a possible communications act, do you, at the union, have a blueprint for the future?
I think controls on ownership and the need for increased plurality and diversity is absolutely vital, and that's something that has to come out of the Communications Act if we're going to have a future for the industry in the UK, because as you say, the local and regional news particularly is in a huge crisis, and it's because of a bankrupt business model that's been employed in those companies over successive years now. It's not because in and of themselves they're not profitable concerns, and there are so many examples where local and regional newspapers are flourishing under the right ownership and the right leadership. But instead, a situation has come about where we've allowed our local and regional newspapers to be run in a way that's effectively now, because of the cuts and the way they've been implemented and the fact that many communities simply don't have a newspaper, we've allowed our local and regional news to be squandered in a way that's absolutely unacceptable, and we need to stop the tide of that and find a way back, because it's simply too important a function in any democratic society.
Let's just deal now with the ethical issues which have been thrown up by the Leveson inquiry, the issues which have so troubled members of the public. Do you think at the moment, because of what's been revealed at the Leveson inquiry, that there has been a chilling effect, for example, on investigative journalism? Many journalists say that they do feel that there has been. What's your impression at the NUJ?
I think there's been a chilling effect on investigative journalism for many years now, in terms of the sense that it's very difficult to even do this journalism in most workplaces, because it's seen as, because it's resource intensive, and because it takes time, and because you need skilled people to carry this out, i.e. it's more expensive than sticking a newspaper full of PR fodder every day, an agency copy, then actually it's become something of an endangered species. So that's been the real threat to investigative journalism. I think it's been a painful time for many journalists, what's been coming out of the Leveson inquiry, partly because, of course, this is not indicative of the reality of journalism for most professional journalists, but it is something that exists. It is a problem that has emerged, and we have to deal with it.
Have you, at the NUJ, formed an opinion, though, on what sort of ethical code you would like the industry to adopt? I mean, on the one hand, we've got the Press Complaints Commission trying to reinvent itself, trying to work with the newspaper editors to bring forward a code. We hear the government say, well, hang on a minute, we quite like the industry to try and sort it out. But at the backstop, one feels that perhaps there's got to be some legislative structure, some sort of scaffolding to make sure that all newspapers comply with whatever is put in place. How have you worked your way through that scenario, Michelle Stanistreet?
Well, the PCC has embarked upon a very expensive, because they've hired lobbyists to do it for them, damage limitation exercise, and they're absolutely set on trying to persuade Leveson that actually all we really need to come out of this inquiry is a PCC Mark II, some sort of tokenistic rebranding exercise, and it's absolutely vital that he doesn't fall for that, and he sees that actually the PCC has had its day, it needs to fold, and we need an absolutely new organisation that is in charge of media accountability, a new form of regulation. It is not for the PCC or the editors of our national newspapers, this self-interested cabal, a gentleman's club as it has become, to dictate what that new organisation should look like and how it should be constituted. They forfeited the right to do that. So I hope that Leveson takes a much more overarching, broader view, because what we really need is a form of regulation that poses genuine accountability, an organisation where the interests of the public are placed at its heart, where the producers of the content, the journalists, actually have a stake in that new organisation. It's absolutely vital that there's a co-regulatory approach. So it's vital that the journalists are also there through their union, and it's vital that members of the public are represented and that they have the majority stake in whatever this new regulatory group is. And I think it's very hard to see how a new group that has real powers, that has the power of investigation, that can audit trends, follow-up trends, whether it's the coverage of asylum seekers within a particular news organisation, It's got to have teeth. We can't have a situation that we've been in for many years now where we have a regulatory body that isn't really doing anything. Third-party complaints have to be accepted. And we think it's very hard to think of how you would achieve that change without some sort of statutory underpinning. And I think, and that's what the NUJ is going to be putting forward as an opportunity. But it's vital that we have a fresh regulatory approach and that we don't allow ourselves to be fobbed off with a PCC Mark II.
Mm-hmm. Well, look, before we go further, Michelle Stanistreet, by asking you how far you think the law and Parliament should intervene, let's turn to Luke Crawley and ask, you obviously have got wide experience of Ofcom, the broadcasting regulator. That has, hasn't it, in the view of many people, managed to carry out this difficult task of regulating broadcasting and television and ethical standards, but not having that chilling effect which some people have said has been or could be the problem in newspapers.
I think I'd agree that Ofcom certainly is a model that's worth looking at very closely indeed. There are definitely problems with Ofcom. You shouldn't run away with the idea that Ofcom as a regulator is a perfect solution. But there's no question the statutory obligation on Ofcom to ensure that certain things happen relating to the number of minutes of broadcast, the kind of coverage, and to look at editorial issues, I think is a very useful reminder that just because something is a commercial company, just because something has a profit motive and shareholders to satisfy, and just because something's doing a lot of journalism and a lot of news coverage, it doesn't mean, therefore, that it can't possibly be regulated in some kind of way, because Ofcom has very successfully regulated ITN and ITV for very many years. I think I would have to agree with Michelle that actually we do need some kind of... The PCC is bust. PCC Max or PCC Mark 2 or 3 is a dead duck. Really, I think, fundamentally, because it's an employer's club that doesn't really want to kind of take decisions that's going to accept all the people sitting around the table. And equally, because people like Desmond from The Express can just say, well, I'm not coming, I'm not going to sit down. Mm-hmm. And I think that whatever you come up with, and I do think that there has to be a place at the table for representatives of the journalists, the workers, the camera people, I mean, however broad you're drawing this, and that needs to be the trade unions, there needs to be a compulsion on the broadcasters, as there is an Ofcom, and a compulsion upon the newspaper owners to actually turn up, sit down, listen to what's said, and be bound by the rulings of that body, whatever it is.
But you'd go along, would you, Luke Crawley, with the general thrust that the fact that the state had to regulate to provide this framework for broadcasting standards, that has stood the test of time, and broadcasters in Britain can hold their head up high and say, we've got a system which has given us the editorial independence we need.
I think that you can say that, because I think you can say without any question ITV, and I agree with Michelle that it is resource hungry doing investigative journalism, but ITV has a long proud record of investigative TV programmes and covering all kinds of things. What it doesn't have is a long shameful record of uncovering which footballer's mistress is sleeping with whom, you know, which, whether you argue it's in the public interest, as some of the newspapers have tried to do, I think it's a fairly crazy distinction to try and come up with. But the fact is, investigative journalism can thrive under a regime such as Ofcom and has done. It's really coming down now to a question of resources. If you're prepared to spend the money, a regulatory regime such as Ofcom will allow you to carry out that investigation. The question is spending the money.
Right then, Michelle Stanistreet, do you think that it's going to be possible to persuade those newspaper proprietors who have, for so long, as you say, wanted to regulate themselves? Do you think it's going to be possible, or will the government have to force them to actually accept a form of state regulation? Or it might be arm's length, but at the end of the day, the state has got to actually provide the scaffold, the framework for an ethical standard which can meet that which applies in broadcasting.
I think the argument has been very polarised, and it's partly because this is the way in which the media bosses have portrayed the argument. It's as if it's a straight choice between the kind of self-regulation we've had under the PCC and state control and interference with the press. And it's not been a particularly helpful polarisation, because, of course, the truth lies somewhere in the middle. And it's perfectly possible to have a system of regulation that's underpinned by statute, so it's enforceable, and so that you don't have this problem of the Richard Desmonds of this world deciding because they're cheapskates or because they don't want to be part of the club, that they can walk out and not be bound by the same responsibilities and rights that other members of the group have had. It's possible to have a structure that works, but that is controlled and by statute, and that's where the NUJ sees the future going. We think there has to be some sort of an underpinning in statute to enable the changes to have teeth and for them to be implemented in the right way. Of course, that's not going to gain the support of the status quo, the employers, as things stand. But if that's the reality that comes out of Leveson, I think they're going to have to be forced to stomach it. And the NUJ would be absolutely against anything that was akin to the licensing of journalists. That's absolutely not where anybody wants to go. That is the state bogeyman that's been depicted as the natural outcome of any form of state intervention in regulating the press. But that doesn't have to be the case. And I think Lord Justice Leveson's made it perfectly clear successively throughout the inquiry that that would not be the route he's going down. So I think it's more about the nuances and the detail. And I think it's perfectly possible that we would get something out of the end of Leveson that, if accepted by the government, communications that gives us the best possible chance of achieving real change that will enable the next generation of journalism to be a lot healthier than the generation that we've just seen pass.
We've been through a very black chapter these last few months for journalists. It's not been a happy moment, has it, for anybody who has earned their life in newspapers. Looking ahead now, we're halfway through this Leveson inquiry. We know that the judge and his assessors are going to come up and try and come up with some proposals come the autumn. How do you finally see this? Are you a little more optimistic than you than the pessimism that you must have had just a few weeks ago when all those terrible, terrible facts were being revealed about what had been going on at News International?
I think if we get to the end of this inquiry and there's some positive change that's introduced as a result of what's been revealed and what the inquiry has listened to and how we've contributed to it in all of this time, that can be a really great step forward for journalism in the round. And I think what's really important at the end of this inquiry is that actually there's a job of work there to do to regain public trust in journalism. And I think the NUJ can play a big role in that. We are pushing forward a model of regulation that is a press council but also an ombudsman, and I think an ombudsman could also play an important role as being not just the face of journalism to the public but also somebody who stands for ethics and standards within the industry as a whole and is somebody that journalists can turn to if they're put under pressure in their workplaces. But I think it is the professionalism of what journalists do day to day in the vast majority of cases is something that we've got to go out there and cheerlead about and to rally public opinion and understanding about the vital role that journalism plays in their lives, in their communities, in our society.
And finally, Luke Crawley from Bechtu. Can Bechtu see this inquiry helping to reinvigorate the whole of the media industry in Britain, in the sense that there's no doubt that this has been a very dark chapter, but if we look at British journalism, British media, it is one of our very strong industries, isn't it? And we I think, as workers in that whole industry, would want that industry to thrive. And that's certainly, I think, one of the big question marks that's been left hanging over in the minds of many people. It's sapped the confidence of people in the whole of the journalistic and media world.
Well, I think it may have had that effect on people, but I think in the main, the most effective, I think, I would hope it have, is an effect upon the owners to make them think twice before allowing or encouraging or even ordering people to go out and gather the kind of salacious muck and gossip and bring it back and present it as, you know, public interest stories of one kind or another. I think if we can hope for anything to come out of Leveson, it will be a framework inside which journalism can flourish, inside which media and broadcasting can flourish. And I think, as we've already said, you know, the lineaments are already there. There's something like Ofcom, some kind of statutory backing, but, you know, with a kind of a panel of some kind that can decide and an ombudsman to kind of review cases. I think that could well come out of Leveson. What I think will definitely come out of Leveson one way or another is a change, because I don't think any government could possibly preside over such a thing and then just say, oh, well, that's all right, we can carry on as before, because it's clearly unacceptable to the majority of people to have such carrying such goings on.
Luke Crawley, thank you, from Bechtu, and Michelle Stanistreet, thank you very much. This is a podcast for the Campaign and Press and Broadcasting Freedom, and it's been produced by Claire Colley.